You only have to say Nigerian prince in the internet age to conjure up the specter of somebody trying to get you to give them money under false circumstances over the net. It's amazing how many emails still arrive telling us that we have a chance to collect an inheritance or otherwise get rich quickly. They are still coming because some of us still fall for them. That is the theme of Maria Konnikova's book, The Confidence Game, While We Fall For It Every Time. Maria Konnikova is a Russian-American writer with a Ph.D. in psychology. She once wrote the Literally Psyched column for Scientific American. She's a regular New Yorker contributor on matters of psychology and culture, and her work has appeared in many other publications. Her last book, Mastermind, How to Think Like Sherlock Holmes, was a bestseller. The Confidence Game came out last year, and tomorrow is the official release date for the paperback edition. Maria Konnikova, good to have you back on The Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me.
It seems like some of the psychology involves not just how cons operate on us, but how most people are just so sure they could never get taken in. Do we all tend to think like that?
I think that most of us do. And even if we are absolutely happy to admit that, you know, oh, sure, perhaps I could fall for a scheme sometimes, if we admit that in kind of theory, in practice, when the right con comes along, we don't even realize we're falling for it. So even those types of people end up unaware and end up falling for cons. And I think that the crucial thing is that none of us want to believe that we could be, you know, silly enough to be deceived by someone or silly enough to actually kind of fall for someone's lies. And instead, we like to think that, you know, we're good judges of characters. We're really, you know, good judges of situations. And lo and behold, we find ourselves the victims of a con artist.
And it seems that the one I hear about most often is the grandmother scam, where later on the woman says, you know, I know about this. I know I shouldn't have been taken, but this woman called. She said she was my granddaughter. She said she was stuck. She needed money, and I took care of her.
Yeah, this is actually such a wonderful scam. Well, not wonderful in the sense that it's actually good.
Wonderful for analysis.
It's obviously
though.
Terrible. Yeah. Yes, but wonderful for analysis. So what happens, let me just quickly tell people who might not be aware of it, is you get a phone call and you're told, you know, your granddaughter, your grandson got into a terrible accident, is in the hospital or was arrested, is in the police department. There are lots of variations on this theme. And what we need to do now is actually get money to either pay for their medical bills or bail them out. But you can't tell their parents, or it's the grandson, granddaughter themselves, which is actually kind of strange, but they're very good at impersonating voices. And what ends up happening is you are so incredibly distraught because this is someone you love. There's a time-sensitive issue that oftentimes you're just not thinking clearly, and so you give the money. And this is actually what con artists do in scam after scam. They get you in this heightened emotional state so that you don't really have time to think. You don't have time to fact check. You just have to react quickly. And so what ends up happening is people give money. And of course, their grandson, their granddaughter is absolutely fine. This wasn't even them. But, you know, it's too late by the time they figure it out.
So is there a single basic need, Maria, that con people know about that they work us with?
No, I think that lots of people have different needs, and con artists are incredibly wonderful at figuring out what your exact need is. So the first step of the con, the put up, is this moment where con artists really case you. They figure out, you know, what are your hopes? What are your dreams? What are your aspirations? What are your fears? Kind of what are your pressure points? And what are the things you want to be true? And then for every given person, they kind of use a variation on a theme to fit those particular kind of hopes, dreams, aspirations, fears, whatever it is, but it's tailored to you. And at the end, I think, yes, you can say that there's something overarching about all of it, which is kind of this need to believe in something, this kind of overarching optimism that we all have, be it that, you know, the world tomorrow is going to be better than the world today, or that we are going to be better people. That's, I think, actually a lot of cons appeal to our desire to do the right thing, to do good, rather than to things like, you know, greed, which people normally associate with con artists.
We move a little bit from the realm of Kant's into religion here, because you include Voltaire's comment about the birth of religion. What was it he said?
Well, he may or may not have said it. It's attributed to, I don't know how many people, Voltaire, Mark Twain, Jean-Paul Sartre, a few other people. And he said religion was born when the first scoundrel met the first fool. And it just sounds so perfect because, you know, you have a scoundrel who figures out, oh, people really need to believe in something. They need to believe in something bigger than themselves. And so I'm going to create this thing. And then the first fool says, oh, that sounds wonderful. This is exactly what I want to believe to be true. So I'll believe it. And that's kind of the rationale behind that. And, you know, I'm not going to go so far as to say I don't want to attack anyone's beliefs that all religion is a con, but there are definitely aspects of religion that really mimic aspects of how cons operate and kind of the principles that they use. And within religions, there are definitely bad actors who are con artists themselves and who use kind of that faith. It's actually a really great breeding ground for con artists are religious organizations, and they often use those as a base for operation. So, you know, so there's definitely, there are definitely a lot of parallels and a lot of crossover. And it's kind of a Venn diagram of, you know, religion and cons, and there's definitely some interception there.
I'm glad you brought up Venn diagrams, because I want to ask about that later in the show. I was going to ask about some overlap in certain categories of people involving cons and conners and people who get conned. We'll get into that later, though. We're talking to Maria Konnikova about her book, The Confidence Game, Why We Fall For It Every Time. We can get your perspective on this as well. You're welcome to join us by phone or by email when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange and talk more about how people gain our confidence when we don't really want to give it to them. We'll return in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Maria Konnikova, a writer with a PhD in psychology. She wrote the best-selling book Mastermind, How to Think Like Sherlock Holmes. The follow-up is called The Confidence Game, Why We Fall For It Every Time. Out in paperback officially tomorrow. She's with us today. You can join us at 800-838-3760 to talk about why we get conned and how. You can also join us by email at jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking about religion briefly. I want to come back to something you just said, Maria, about how people sometimes use religion as a base of operations for a con.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely right. So I think a con that's probably fresh in everyone's memory is Bernie Madoff, one of the biggest kind of cons in recent history. And one of the reasons that Madoff was so successful was that he leveraged his influence within the Jewish community. And he was able to do this and already kind of leverage the fact that these people trusted him because he was kind of part of the same group, and that these were the types of people who, you know, are religious believers. So they actually believe in something. And one of the things that you find is that there aren't a lot of things that make people more or less susceptible to cons in terms of personality traits. But one thing that is a little bit predictive is religiosity. So religious people do often end up being better victims than non-religious people because they already kind of have that mindset. They're already willing to take certain things on faith, so to speak. And that's something that con artists exploit. And throughout history, we see this. So there's a Ponzi scheme that I write about in the book, where you have someone who used the Episcopalian Church to actually kind of find a group of victims. So this happens often. And then you sometimes have religious leaders who end up using their flock to actually perpetrate cons. So I write about this couple, the Pattons, who ended up, they were evangelical preachers, but they were con artists, and they basically took advantage of their flock to have a personal bank. And one of them was a gambling addict, one of them was addicted to fine clothes, and they just took these people for all they were worth, because they were such good preachers that they were able to kind of convince everyone that it was a wonderful idea to keep giving more and more money to the congregation, even though they never saw any of the returns of that money.
So the people who do the conning prey upon people who have some needs that or beliefs anyway that get fulfilled. But let's come back to the needs of the people doing the conning, because what, for example, prompted a guy named Fred DeMara to pass himself off as a number of other people, including a naval surgeon?
Yeah, so DeMara is actually a wonderful example. He is also known as the Great Imposter just because of how many different people he impersonated. And yes, not only did he impersonate a naval surgeon, but he actually operated on people, which is kind of crazy considering that not only did he not have a medical degree, he never finished high school. So this is someone with no credentials whatsoever who decides it's a great idea to wield a scalpel and cut people open during the Korean War. Yep. So yikes was my reaction as well. But I think to answer your question, the motivation of people like him isn't actually money. So he didn't get any financial gain from any of this. It's power. It's power over people. It's power to know that you are playing with people's realities, that you control them. I mean, if you look at the doctor example, I mean, the guy is literally playing God. He's playing with life and death. And it's a huge rush to be able to kind of control people to that extent. And that's the theme I see running through every single con artist that I've encountered over my years kind of doing research and working on this, is that they really are motivated by nothing so much as power.
We are talking about The Confidence Game, the book by Maria Konnikova, subtitled Why We Fall For It Every Time, here on the Jefferson Exchange. So we do seem to celebrate imposters, though, like Frank Abagnale. We made the whole movie Catch Me If You Can about him.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, it's really difficult not to. So one of the things that happened to me as I was researching the book, so I was meeting with con artists, I was speaking with them, and about halfway through my research process, I realized that I had to stop because I became way too sympathetic to them. And I started, you know, I wasn't an objective reporter anymore. I would listen to them and I'd be like, oh, you know, he really is a good guy. He just had some bad life breaks. And I think that the reason they're so successful is they're insanely charismatic. You know, they are people who really do appeal to you. They know how to work the charm. You don't see them as con artists. You actually say, oh, this is a really nice person. And you kind of grudgingly admire what they do because, I mean, you have to, yeah, it's scary and it's terrible that someone was able to operate on people without a medical degree. But then you kind of look at it and you say, wow, you know, this guy deceived so many people and was just so brazen that you have to have a grudging admiration for the talent that allows something like that to happen. And in the case of someone like Abagnale, it's actually even easier because Abagnale only operated for a few years as a teenager, and his cons didn't go to the point of, you know, I am playing with life and death. So it was easier to kind of look at him and to think, oh, you know, kid having fun, ha, ha, ha. But it's definitely tempting to exonerate them when we really shouldn't. We should not be whitewashing what they do.
You draw a quick parallel with magicians in here. What's the connection, Maria?
Well, I think that magicians operate the exact same way as con artists, but on an actual perceptual level. And they're not fooling you without your knowledge. They're fooling you with your knowledge. You want to be deceived when you go see a magician. But magicians operate on the perceptual level. So they actually, you know, they work with visual illusions. They know how to manipulate your attention so that you pay attention to what they want you to pay attention to and not the other things that are going on. They're really wonderful storytellers. So the best magician isn't the person who has the best sleight of hand. It's the person who's able to captivate the audience, capture their attention, tell the best story so that the act as a whole succeeds. And that's exactly what con artists do on kind of a higher level rather than actual, you know, visual perception. I'm going to, you know, substitute this in for this. They do it with reality. So they do it on kind of this more abstract plane, but they do the same thing. They tell stories and they manipulate our attention, and the best con artists aren't the ones who have kind of the best skills of deception. They're the best storytellers. They're the people who are best able to manipulate the world, to manipulate our attention. And the biggest difference between magicians is they do it without our knowledge. So we have no idea. It's not like we signed up to be deceived by con artists, whereas we do sign up to be deceived by magicians.
Okay, so there is a all right. It's a magic trick in slow motion in one sense, but the other part where you say we at least we want to be tricked by magicians, so it raises the question whether we like being tricked. I mean, you know, whether it's sort of like we like to scare ourselves by going on roller coasters, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely something to be said for that. I think one of the psychological principles that I talk about in the book is something known as the optimism bias, which is basically that we do see the world through rose-colored glasses. So people don't see reality as it is. They over and over end up seeing themselves and events in a more positive light. And when you kind of ask, for instance, you know, how nice are you, or how much do you weigh, or all sorts of questions, you know, from any broad spectrum, and then you ask other people about that person, you see that the judgments don't match up at all. People are way too nice about themselves, and on all bad features, they think that they don't have those features at all. And there's one exception, which is the clinically depressed. So people who are clinically depressed are actually very accurate in their judgments and in their answers, which is really, really interesting because it shows that this optimism bias, seeing the world in a kind of more hopeful and optimistic way, is really psychologically adaptive. Because when we see that, you know, we don't like to see the world as it is. The world as it is sucks, and it's not really nice to be in it. So it's nice to kind of deceive yourself a little bit. And so in that sense, yeah, we do want to be tricked. And con artists know this. So they don't show us the world as it is. They show us the version of the world that we already see in our heads. That's why we believe them, because we're like, yeah, that's what I've been saying. Thank you. And they really jump on that.
Maria Konnikova is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is called The Confidence Game, Why We Fall For It Every Time, out in paperback officially as of tomorrow, January 10th. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760. Remember, we just use first names, so maybe you've been taken. You have a story to relate about sometimes somebody asked you for something and you thought, well, I couldn't be fooled. And you got fooled. It happens is the point of the book. And we learn how. 800-838-3760. Email jx@jeffnet.org. So what is the trend? I mean, despite the fact that we seem to regard ourselves as con-free, is the trend going up? Are more people being defrauded over time?
You know, I don't think that the trend is going up. Let me put a little asterisk by that statement, which is to say that we don't have good numbers about cons, because most of them are never caught and most of them are never reported. So we don't actually know. But from as far as we can tell, it's not going up so much as it's changing. So before, and it's becoming easier. So before, all cons had to happen in person. But now, you know, you've got email, you've got social media, you've got all sorts of ways that people can get conned. And so I think that the techniques are becoming more and more accessible, and it's becoming easier to reach more people. So the original Nigerian prince, who I write about in the book, he had to take out a newspaper advertisement, and people had to read the newspaper, and it was this whole thing. Now a would-be Nigerian prince can just send out an email, a massive spam email, to thousands and thousands and thousands of people at once and get immediate responses. So in that sense, it's becoming much more prevalent.
Do the numbers only admit people who or include people who admit being defrauded? Because I wonder if maybe the reporting is a little low on this.
Yeah, well, the reporting is definitely low because of two reasons. One, some people don't even realize they've been conned. Two, some people are so incredibly embarrassed that they won't admit it even after they realize it. And so because of that, I think we do vastly underestimate the number of people who've been conned, but we've always been underestimating it. I think that's a problem that hasn't gotten worse. It's just a matter of human psychology. Who wants to say, yep, me, I fell for it. I think that a lot of people would rather just slink away and pretend nothing happened. There's this great con artist of the 20th century, one of the greatest, Victor Lustig, who is known as Count Lustig, even though he's not a count. But, you know, he had that nickname because he was so incredibly good. And he managed to sell the Eiffel Tower twice to different sets of investors. So he had this whole story about how it was going to be used for scrap metal because France was in debt. They were going through a war. You know, it actually kind of in some perverse world made sense. And the reason he was able to do it twice to two sets of investors is the first set was so embarrassed because these were actual businessmen that they never told anyone. So he was able to, you know, get away with it twice using the exact same scam.
There's a line late in the introduction about people who think The Onion prints real news, and which, of course, this category seems to have mushroomed a bit in recent years.
This is absolutely right. And it's actually a little bit scary because we're not that well-equipped. Our brains aren't that well-equipped to be able to kind of weed out false news. There have now been a number of studies that show that people are just as likely to believe false news as real news if it conforms with their pre-existing beliefs. So if it's a false news story, but it's something that either politically or, you know, from some other ideological motivation, you already think that this story is likely to be true, you're going to believe it and you won't have any sorts of red flags go off, such as, oh, like this is a little bit bizarre. Maybe this is actually a fake news site. People don't even think it. And so you have people posting, you know, on Facebook, did you see this story? And you say, well, didn't you bother to fact check? Absolutely not, because it's something that you already want to believe. And so you assume it's true.
It's interesting. It seems like the incidence of sharing something on Facebook is in direct proportion to the amount of outrage you felt when you first read it. You're more likely to slap it up quickly if it really got you annoyed.
That's exactly right. And that is something that con artists and false news organizations absolutely love, because this is what we were talking about back in the grandparent scam. When you're emotional, you're not rational. So what you need to do is get that emotion ratcheted up, and all of a sudden your rational brain kind of recedes and you make bad decisions and you believe things you maybe shouldn't believe, and you part with your money in the case of the grandparent, or you post it on Facebook in the case of, you know, false news or The Onion or whatever it is, and you end up, you know, falling for something that's simply not true because in the moment you're so enraged or scared or whatever it is, you're so emotionally heated that you cannot think straight.
Well, you know, the weird thing is that even people who should be skeptics can get taken. And I'm talking about back to more financial sorts of things. Justin Peters of Slate, you relate the story about him seeking some air miles so that he could make some travel plans.
Yes, indeed. So he wanted to go to Italy for vacation. And he decided, you know, the tickets are very expensive. Why don't I buy some airline miles and then use those miles to buy my tickets? And that can actually be much more lucrative. So he puts up this ad on Craigslist, which, as we know, never has any scams ever. It's totally legitimate every single time. And he has this guy respond. And they have this whole exchange. He says he's an airline pilot, so he has all of these miles that he never uses. So, you know, Justin sends him money and the miles never come. And this happens to him twice. And I don't think, you know, Justin is far from a stupid person. He's actually incredibly smart and an incredibly kind of someone who should not be falling for something like that. But, you know, he has no reason. Well, he thinks he has no reason to suspect anything foul because he's spoken to these guys on the phone. One of them even sends him a driver's license, which obviously ends up being fake, but they, you know, it seems legitimate. And why would someone want to take advantage of you like that? Obviously for many, many reasons, but in the moment when you really want to believe it's true, you know, Justin really wanted to go on vacation. Time was running out. If he didn't buy the tickets, he wouldn't be able to go. So there was definitely time pressure there. So he was in a stressful situation. And so he chose to believe what he wanted to believe rather than seeing the red flags. And I think that before we judge him, we should realize just how susceptible we are to doing the exact same thing, given the right circumstances.
Well, part of this is the optimism you referred to before, that we want to believe that people are good and kind. And this guy's really cool. He's going to sell me his air miles for a song. Well, oops.
That's absolutely right. And I think the second part of the equation is that most people aren't actually con artists. So we get rewarded for our optimism because most people aren't out to get us. And so normally when we think that something is legit, it ends up actually being legit. And so over and over we have that. And so when there are red flags, we don't necessarily see them because we don't want to see them.
Well, I guess that we should consider it a nice element of human nature that at least we believe that people should be trusted in a lot of circumstances, but we're talking about the circumstances in which they shouldn't be trusted. Maria Konnikova's book is called The Confidence Game, While We Fall For It Every Time. We'll come back and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to relate your own stories or ask some questions of Maria's research, which is extensive. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Maria Konnikova, who tells a good story and has written quite a number of works. She also holds a PhD in psychology, so she gets to write a lot about psychology and culture. She wrote the book Mastermind, How to Think Like Sherlock Holmes. That landed on the bestseller list. The follow-up is called The Confidence Game, Why We Fall For It Every Time. We talked to her last year when it was out in hardback. It's out in paperback as of tomorrow, and you can join the conversation. Questions about the ways in which human beings respond to cons on either end of the transaction, or perhaps a story to tell of your own if you're not too embarrassed to tell it. Remember, we go first names only here on The Exchange. We'd love to hear from you at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Maria, you play some bait and switch yourself here in the book because you say con artists are evil human beings, but then you turn around and pull that definition away later in the sentence.
That is absolutely right, because I think that we'd all love to just dismiss them and say, you know, oh, this is a bad person. This is a psychopath. We love saying psychopath without really understanding what we're saying. This is someone who's just terrible, terrible, rotten, because a normal person would never do anything like this. The fact of the matter is that, yes, a few con artists are psychopaths, but few and far between. Most of them are more or less just regular people who had some sort of predisposition to this. And I write about something known as the dark triad of traits, which is psychopathy, narcissism, and Machiavellianism. And narcissism, we have a shiny example of it right now in the news every single day. But if you're not aware of that example, it's just this overblown sense of self and of entitlement that this is actually, I'm not doing anything wrong because I am entitled to get everything that I'm taking from people. But the single most important trend, I think, is Machiavellianism, which is this ability to persuade people to get them to do your bidding without them realizing that that's what you're doing. So it's kind of this very sly method of persuasion. And what I end up showing is that you can have the dark triad and not be a con artist. So it's overrepresented in con artists, but it's also overrepresented in business students, in lawyers, in marketers, in advertisers, in people who you'd never say, oh, these are evil people, because for the most part, they're not. They're, you know, people who are making a living. And really, when you have the con artist, I think it's not just the predisposition, it's also the circumstances, it's also the opportunities, it's how their life turned out. And so we can't really dismiss them all under the bucket of bad person. It's someone who was turned a certain way based on certain things that happened in their life.
Well, I'm really struck by the fact that they don't, con artists don't seem to have a lot of empathy themselves, but they can use others against them. So in other words, they see it in other people, but not in themselves.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. They're very good at reading people, and because they themselves are not emotionally involved, they're usually very well able to kind of turn off that emotional empathy. They end up being more observant than people who are more empathetic and more kind of emotionally involved with the world. So think about, you know, when you're feeling outrage, when you're feeling so sad for someone else, you're emotional, you're not thinking well, you're actually not making judgments that are as good. But if you're someone who's kind of coldly rational, you can see that in other people and say, this person is vulnerable right now. Why don't I go ahead and take advantage of it? Why don't I say, I can mimic the same thing. I can say, yes, I definitely understand what you're going through. It's so terrible, blah, blah, blah. And all the while, you're actually, because you're not emotionally aroused, you're still logical. You're still thinking clearly. And that's a crucial advantage when it comes to kind of getting people to do what you want them to do. Because if one of you is rational and one of you isn't, who do you think is going to come out ahead in any sort of a negotiation or discussion?
Yeah, the rational one for sure. Here's where we come exactly. back to the Venn diagram that we talked about earlier. And in this case, I wanted to ask about psychopaths and cons, whether one dictates the other. I mean, not all psychopaths are con people, but not all con people are psychopaths. How does that all work?
That's exactly right. So you have psychopaths, which is actually a very precise term. You can't just call someone a psychopath because they act in a way that you don't like. Psychopathy is the kind of the inability to experience emotions the way that a non-psychopathic brain does. And it's predicated on anatomy. So a psychopathic brain is actually anatomically different from a non-psychopathic brain. The emotional parts of the brain are a different size. The emotional connections are different. So you really don't experience the world in the same way. And you can't really feel those sort of empathetic, warm emotions the way that other people do. And while some con artists certainly are psychopaths, what I say is that, yeah, it is a Venn diagram, that there's an overlap, but the overlap is much smaller than the stuff that's outside the overlap, the rest of the circle. There's one really interesting story of this neuroscientist who was doing a study on Alzheimer's, and he used his family as kind of control brains. You know, this is what a non-Alzheimer's brain looks like. And he was also running a study on psychopaths. And at some point, he's looking through the scans, and as in any psychology study, everything is anonymous. You're not supposed to be able to tell whose data is whose. And he comes across a psychopath brain within the Alzheimer's patients, and he says, one of our lab technicians must have messed up. I need to remedy this, so I need to de-anonymize it and figure out what's going on. And so he goes through this entire process to try to figure out what's going on so that the data isn't corrupted. And it ends up that he is the one who has the psychopathic brain.
Wow.
So it was no one messed up. He was actually living his whole life as a psychopath.
This is James Fallon, right?
Yep, this is James Fallon. Mm-hmm. And as he writes in his book, his wife wasn't surprised at this revolution, but he himself was. And so you see that you can actually be a psychopath and lead a completely, not just a normal life, but the life of someone who's really giving back to society and who is excelling and making the world a better place. And so it's really, I think, a question of where are you coming from? What kind of, you know, how has your life evolved? What kinds of circumstances have you found yourself in? And you can have the predisposition and end up being a neuroscientist or end up being a con artist.
Wow. We have a bunch of calls waiting to talk to you. Let's go to Kimberly in Medford first. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Maria Konnikova, the author of The Confidence Game. Hi, Kimberly.
Hello. How are you?
Good. You?
I'm doing well. So what I was going to tell you about, we were involved in a Ponzi scheme many years ago. Utah has a reputation for being the con capital of the world. People are very trusting, and especially within the religion of the LDS Church, Mormons. And this man had been our bishop had told us to go to this guy, and he sold insurance, and he was promising, you know, that usual, if it's too good to be true, it is. It was like a 60% return. And my husband got a bad feeling, and he insisted, he demanded that all our money be pulled out, and we got all our money back, and about like a week later, it all fell apart, and the federal government was investigating the man, and he was convicted of running a Ponzi scheme. So it is very, you know, I think that's one of the things you talk about, sort of that the vulnerabilities and the ways that you can associate with people and, you know, trusting people, especially within your own sort of cultural group. This mm-hmm. happened to be within a religious group. So it is easy to be taken in.
All right. Thanks for that, Kimberly. Appreciate that. And that goes right to what you're talking about, Maria, before, about getting people within a religion as a base of operations, where if your association makes the connection.
Absolutely, because you already trust people who are in the same kind of milieu, who believe in the same things. Because we actually, there's a lot of work that shows that we are more trusting of people who are more similar to you than people who are different from you. And this goes to beliefs. This goes to something like what you actually look like. There's a really fun study where people were playing a cooperation game on the computer with someone else. And actually, there was no second person. It was just a photograph that they thought represented someone else. And the photograph was altered. So either it was really a stranger, or the stranger's photograph was merged with that person's own photograph. And they ended up cooperating more and saying much better things about and trusting the person who physically resembled them, because their photograph was used to create the image, than the other people. And they didn't realize it. When they, you know, rated them, they had no idea that this was someone who looked like them. It's actually kind of crazy, but, you know, trust is really based on familiarity and similarity, and religious groups get at the heart of all of that. And so, kudos to her husband for realizing that something might be a little bit off and actually getting out.
Well, the familiarity one I found really fascinating, particularly when you brought in the black bag experiment at Oregon State University from the 60s. How did that unfold?
That was actually, I love that study. It's pretty ingenious. There's a seminar that meets every week, and unbeknownst to the students, they're also running a social experiment on them, which involves liking and what makes people like other people. And so they have this guy come into the seminar every single week wearing a bag, an actual paper bag on him, and at first, people were like, what in the world is going on? This is really weird. Why do we have this bag sitting in our seminar? And the bag doesn't say anything. The bag just kind of sits there. And so that's kind of step one. And then they just observe, the psychologists observe how these people respond to this bag. And what ends up happening is that by the end of the seminar, they like him. So now they're saying good things about the bag. They've given the bag a gender. It's now he. They talk about him. They say nice things about him. And the only thing that's happened is that they just are exposed to this bag over and over and over. And so what you see is that when you become familiar with something, you start feeling warm towards it, even if it's a person wearing a bag who's never said a single word and just sits there.
Wow.
But now it's your bag. You feel proprietary. You feel kind of, if someone attacks the bag, you're going to defend that bag.
Wow. Familiarity just leads to all sorts of warm feelings down the road. That's amazing. Let's take a call here from Casey in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, Jeff, Maria. Great show this morning. How are you guys?
Good. Doing well. What you got?
Okay. Well, back a long time ago, my grandmother got scammed by somebody called in, and they said, okay, we'll send you these booklets that will tell you how to save money. So that's what got her. And as soon as she did, it took about 6 months before we got any booklets. And then turns out they got into her bank account and pretty much stripped her dry. But on a side note, though, besides that, what I wanted to say was I used to do telemarketing. I used to sell these things called treasure chest books.
Oh, sure.
That was about 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. But anyway, one of our main selling points that we used to have to say was you get a free oil change and a free vacation. And it's like as soon as I said that, that immediately made people, like, you know, turn their heads and go, okay, this must be some kind of a scam. And they were pretty adamant about sticking to the script. And so I just noticed that when I deviated from the script a little bit and didn't mention that, I could sell a lot more of those little units.
Wow, that's really interesting. Casey, thanks. I want to get a time for a response from Maria. We're getting close on time here. Maria, go ahead.
Two things. First, the scam that happened to your grandmother, incredibly common. And, you know, it's you can't even blame her because, you know, you're offered discounts. And oftentimes people are roped in by something seemingly innocuous, like, oh, you know, this is a discount. And if you think about it, actually, a lot of sales are scams on a smaller scale because they're not actually sales. You just say, oh, we're discounting it off. And all you have to do is say one price, cross it out, and put a lower price, and people are going to buy it.
Oh, sure.
At a much higher frequency than if you just had the lower price on its own, because the lower price is how much it actually costs. So I don't blame his grandmother at all. And the telemarketing thing, yep, that's definitely very perceptive of him.
Wow, so much ground we didn't get to cover again. The confidence game, why we fall for it every time. Maria Konnikova wrote it and joined us again on The Exchange. Maria, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
All right, take it easy. That'll do it for today's Exchange.